Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is one of an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Over the past 10 years, Richmond's cultural art scene has been quietly growing, attracting numerous talented artists with national and international reputations. Twice a month, on the first and third Mondays, we will sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. The conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we're having lunch with Javier Tapia.
Welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Timbo.
Okay. And before we started, you said you'd like to answer in Spanish. So if you could tell us a little bit about your life and our...
Bueno, empecemos en español.
The possibilities in Spanish. No, just kidding. But obviously, from your accent, listeners can tell that you're not from this country. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Lima, Peru. Mm-hmm. I was born in Lima, grew up in the capital until I was about 21, and I moved on to the States.
Really? That's quite a story.
So
there you were, a poor, poverty-stricken Peruvian child living in a shack outside of Lima. Now you're smiling. That's not quite right, eh?
Not quite right.
No.
It was more like... you know, that during my years in Peru, early years, you know, I was studying in a private school, very, very good private school. And although my parents weren't very well off, they really believed in education. So studied in a very, very good school. We had most of the things that we needed to grow up in a kind of a middle class environment.
Right. Okay. But you didn't start out being an artist, right?
Nope.
When you went to college or university?
Industrial engineering for, University of Lima.
Really?
For, engineering.
Engineering. Mm-hmm. Really? So there was a natural transition between engineering and becoming a painter? Or?
How about four different transitions?
Really? What were the four transitions?
Communications, mass communications. Then I had also architecture, uh-huh, and administration, business.
Really?
Administration.
Okay, so what... Your father was a successful businessman, right?
Kind of, yes.
And your grandfather was a doctor.
That's right.
And your brothers are various doctors...
More like a lawyer.
Businessmen, lawyers.
Business, CEO. Thing,
but successful
like
guys.
Very successful, yes.
Okay, well, whatever prompted you to decide to throw your entire life away and become an artist?
I don't know. Should we say passion?
That horrible thing, passion.
That horrible thing that gets in the way.
Gets in the way. No, talk about that. Really, talk about that. Because there you were, middle class, upper middle class kid, growing up in a fairly... entitled, if that's the word you want, entitled environment. You had an opportunity to become an engineer or to become a businessman, and you decided to become the lowly artist.
It was dreadful.
I mean, tell me about that struggle. What was that?
I was beginning to study. My parents, both my mother and my father, but more my father, believed that because I liked to draw, that I should be an architect. So I tried to apply for architecture school, and in Peru the system is not the same. You go into a university or you try to apply to a university, you have to give a test, and only, let's say, 500 out of 25,000 people that apply get in. You know, it's
500 out of 25,000, one in five, one in 50. One in somebody out there, do the math and call us.
So basically, I didn't get into my first attempt to architecture, and I applied for engineering, thinking that I would just have to, I would basically transfer my credits. And that's what I did. I applied to engineering. I got into engineering, which was much harder to get into. But I never followed up. I by then I already liked to draw so much, and I realized that I didn't like engineering at all. Mm-hmm. That I started to move away from that, and instead of applying for architecture, I went straight to the fine art school and applied there, gave a test, got in. And the problem was that because I applied to the fine arts and I got accepted, I had to review, go do all my academics again, They would not transfer any of my credits.
Really? How long had you been in engineering school?
About 3.5 years.
Really?
So I would lose all of that.
Really?
Yes.
So what I'm getting at here is that I think a lot of people who look at art, appreciate art, and a lot of people who don't, really want to understand that, you know, why in the world would someone with 3.5 years in an engineering program throw away all that security, all those years of school, to become an artist?
But security with what, though?
What do you mean?
Security, maybe. At that time, I wasn't even thinking about any security at all. I was just trying to find out my calling, if you want to call it that way.
I mean,
it was more like I was drawing about 6 to 8 hours a day while everybody was going at the beach.
Right.
And I realized, what am I doing engineering? Engineering would probably put me in a spot where, or maybe financially would be sound.
But I think that's an incredibly, I think that that's an incredibly courageous decision at a young age. I think a lot of people wake up in their 40s and all of a sudden go, what am I, you know. I mean, I think there's a certain amount of, I think for artists, for many artists, there's a certain amount of courage in deciding to become an artist. Because, I mean, did you think you were ever going to make any money? Did you think you were ever going to, you know?
Actually, no. To tell you the truth, maybe as an engineer, yes.
Right.
But as an artist, they became very clear from the beginning that I wasn't doing this for the money.
All right. And so where was your family around this? Were they?
They actually, my father, when I told him that I was leaving.
Right.
And on top of that, I was getting married. So he looked at me and he said, do what you need to do and I will support you.
Really?
And he was amazing. In that way, it was an amazing, both my parents were really, really supportive of me becoming an artist.
All right, so you went to art school in Lima, Peru. Did you feel as though it was a good education?
Actually, I got into school, but I promised that to myself. If I would get into, accept, do the test, and if I would get accepted into the fine arts program in the Universidad Católica in Peru, then I would not follow in. I would not register. I would come to the States.
Oh, okay.
Because they would not give me credit for the, they would not transfer my credits. So in the States, they would. And all I had to do when I arrived here in the States was all take painting classes.
Oh, no, wait a minute. So the States took your engineering classes?
Yes.
Oh, really?
All my academics.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't have to do any academics.
Okay, so where'd you go to school here?
In Santa Monica College first, in California.
Right.
And then I went to I got a scholarship at the University of Texas at Austin.
So did you speak English when you came here? You did?
Yes.
Okay, but still, leaving your home, leaving your family, coming to a new country to become an artist.
Yes.
And that's a fairly, something was driving you fairly strongly.
Oh, absolutely. I think that the idea of, it was either go to Europe or come to the States. And for some reason, everybody was traveling to Europe at that time. I made a decision that I wanted to go to the States because it was less known. Although I was hearing that the programs, the art schools here in America were, first of all, I knew I could speak English.
Right.
You know, I was taught English in elementary school and also high school. And so, but I didn't speak any French.
So something inside of you, something very strong inside of you, told you at a fairly young age that you needed to be an artist.
Yes.
All right. So you got here, you went to school, and then you went on to graduate school?
Graduate school.
Where'd you do graduate school?
University of Texas. I did my two last years of undergraduate at University of Texas at Austin, and I got accepted in the graduate school there as well.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about your work, because that's kind of, I mean, I think it is interesting to talk to artists about why they became artists or how they became artists, and I think a lot can't really answer it except to say, well, I couldn't not do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something about it I could not do. But the work that you were doing in Peru, where did that work come from? What was it about? Can you talk about that a little bit?
I start doing...
Because Peru was... pretty much in the throes of a revolution at that time.
Well,
right?
it was a very unstable situation. The In 1968, Velasco Alvarado took over. I was in school then. But the president after president, it was a very unstable, you know, politically speaking, situation in Peru. And
The Shining Path, I guess, was there.
That was a little later. That was when I was already in my last year of undergraduate and my three years of graduate school. The Shining Path was, I was waiting for my action, my green card, my visa.
Did that actually affect your life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't go back to Peru for about 3 or 4 years.
No, I mean the Shining Path and the...
The Shining Path, no, because it was more, although they were active then, it wasn't bad enough that we would hear stuff that was happening in Peru when I was in Peru then. But it was much more noticeable, and the war, I mean...
What kind of work were you making then?
I was doing political cartoons.
Really?
Believe it or not. I was doing political cartoons. I was illustrating articles for magazines. Mm-hmm. I remember the cartoons are really coming, that come to my mind are one on like a general cutting a paper book, that and the book that he's cutting is... It's the Derechos Humanos, which is the human rights.
So it's cutting
so
it up.
So he's cutting it up.
Right.
And making little dolls and making little origami things, you know.
Origami, a Spanish word. For those of you who don't know what origami means, what is the word for origami in Spanish?
Origami?
In Spanish. Is there a Spanish word for it? No, I guess it would be origami, right?
I guess so.
Because origami is Japanese?
It's Japanese.
Yes. But if you didn't know, there's a lot of Japanese living in Peru, by the way. As a matter of fact, the last exiled president of Peru was Fujimori, right?
Fujimori.
Was Japanese. It's an incredible story. We won't get into it right now, but if you look it up on the web under Peru/Japan...
Fujimori.
Fujimori. Look, and then you can get back to us about the what's the percentage of people who get into Peruvian colleges, if it's 50 to 500 or whatever the heck we were talking about before. But anyway, before I get completely insane here, I just want to say this is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us, and we're talking with Javier Tapia, who is a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, professor who teaches painting, and grew up in Lima, Peru, had an opportunity to become an engineer, and decided no, and has taken an interesting path in his life. We're talking a little bit about that and a little bit about his art. We started to talk about some of the art you were doing in Peru, but as you came here, did the art become less political, more emotional? What? Tell me a little bit about about your art.
Well, like I told you, I mean, I started with some political cartoons, illustrating magazine articles in Peru. But when I came here, everything, I had never seen acrylics in my life.
A what?
Acrylic paint.
Acrylic paint, yeah.
And it was so, like, it was amazing how I got to discover materials that I had never seen, and brushes that I had never seen, and stuff that I wanted to experiment with.
Why brushes? I mean, artists, it is interesting. You know, you when you say brushes, you know, you might as well be talking about, you know, bosoms. I mean, it's like your eyes get big, you get a big smile. Your brushes I've never seen. I mean, most of us, that's sort of a, you know, really?
It was that.
Why brushes? Why?
Brushes, materials, different paints, different kinds of, I've never...
So it opens up opportunities of expression.
Not only expression, but also because I like to experiment. I was limited. When I was in Peru, I realized that I had such a limited exploration of materials.
Because
I was just doing India ink drawing.
Okay.
Pencil drawing.
Right.
And I wasn't really... At that time, we didn't have... in Peru, because Peru is a poor country, and the governments were so controlling of the dollar, we could not import the kinds of painting and paints and brushes that you would hear. But here, you would go to any store.
So you came to America and found the streets indeed were paved with paint and acrylics and
stuff.
Brushes in abundance, which is true, you know, but it's true.
It was amazing.
So what did it allow you to do? What did you start doing?
Well, I started to do these huge paintings on acrylic, and I started to experiment with with ectempora and other mediums, and but just as a very important facet exploratory wise, you know, mm-hmm. in trying to explore different mediums.
So you're exploring mediums, materials, that kind of thing.
But making also very abstract works, which I didn't allow myself to do when I was in Peru.
Choice of words, allow. Mm-hmm. What, say more about that.
That in Peru, because I was so much dedicated to doing the cartoons that I was doing, and everybody else wanted me to somehow follow up with a cartoon.
Right.
I was working, I was already hired by these magazines to do these drawings. As soon as I got here, I wasn't hired by anybody,
mm-hmm.
and therefore I was able to allow myself to do these things that I would not, you know, that they were not made. They were not made for money.
Right, since nobody was paying you, you could.
I had the right to do it.
So it was a lot of freedom.
More freedom. Yes.
Okay. All right. So in terms of, we have an understanding of it in terms of materials. But in terms of content, what were you about? What were you doing?
I stopped doing the political cartoons, and the subject went from...
You started doing abstract political cartoons.
More or less abstract
but
paintings.
But abstract, yeah.
But more or less abstract paintings. And I realized that I was introducing that also as a way for me to ease my way into exploring them with the medium as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a criticism that a couple of professors laid on me that really, Xavier, where is your content? What does
that word mean for those who don't?
Content, what I think it's more in relationship to is content, I think what it means is what does the work evoke? What are the complexities of the work, mm-hmm. as you do it, as how you're painting, what you're painting, what tools you're using evoke? You know, after you
so
see.
So, how are you making it, and what's it about?
Is that
sound of what you're saying?
The evocation of an artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what does
what
the
it's
work
trying
evoke?
To evoke? Okay.
Right.
All right. So, what was your work trying to evoke?
It was trying to do expression in the sense of movement. It was trying to be more about moving. I had paintings that were, I call them relaciones místicas, mystical relationships,
mm-hmm.
and I was like reading a lot about Chimú cultures and pre-Inca cultures and
Chimuco,
Chimú, pre-Columbian cultures,
yeah.
before the Incas,
yes,
and so I was basically reading some of the mythologies and mythological stories that mm-hmm. are related to the ancient Peru,
and then
it changed dramatically because my content went from that to Shining Path.
Well, hang on, because I think this will help people who are listening to this, some of whom know a lot about art, some of whom know nothing. You know, I think a lot of people look at a picture and they say, "Is it a pretty picture or isn't it a pretty picture?" That's about as far as it goes sometimes in our culture. And what you're talking about is actually reading something, thinking about it, and then creating a visual representation of that experience?
Correct.
Or those insights?
That's right.
How do you do that?
Well, you read it, and then you begin to think about what, you know, you want the color to do and what you want the tools that you're manipulating to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you begin to... have a feel, for example, of how loud do you have, if you have anything to say about that subject in particular.
But how does an abstract painting represent mythology? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, and...
I hope that's not too stupid a question.
No, actually, no? I think it's a very good question, but at the same time, I feel like I'm not so sure that it can, but it wasn't, for me, a point where I would stop. It stopped me to try. You know, it's like...
Well, it wasn't a literal translation. It wasn't like you were trying to translate mythology into a visual image. Was it more about trying to capture something that had been... I don't know.
Let me give you a description. For example, there's a little story in the Chimú culture, for example. There is I don't know what to call it, a story, legend, whatever, that basically says that the moon is more important than the sun,
mm-hmm.
because the moon appears during the day and during the night. And in that logical kind of, it was really producing in me a way of rethinking some things. Mm-hmm. Like, because we always see the sun as, you know, right, a very important, you know, a star kind of providing what we need in order to live. But the moon was always is left behind somehow.
Deconstructing the concept of the sun being important, sort of. Really? Says who?
But in a way, so I did a painting, which was about 7 feet high, where I put these two circles. And around that those two circles, there were these massive areas of acrylic paint going, surrounding, mm-hmm, swirling around both. One was smaller than the other. And, of course, moon, sun, you could not tell.
Right.
Because you were basically addressing it just, they were both white, very, very white, instead of one, let's say, yellow and the other one white. And on in a very black a background, mm-hmm, a very dark background. So although you cannot really literally portray, know how to, let's say, devise a specific kind of thing related to that kind of story, you can still try to try to figure out a way of understanding the kind of the stories that you don't quite understand. They come from a very different perspective than you were taught initially.
Mm-hmm. So the whole thrust of it is questioning what you've come to believe is absolute and saying, maybe not.
And absolutely, that still follows.
I mean, sort of postmodern. Yes. In a sense.
I don't even know if I can label it like, you know, postmodern, but I think that I bet that it does have a relationship.
Well, there's no such thing as absolute knowledge.
Yes.
There just isn't. It doesn't exist.
Exactly.
And that was really what captured you, sort of that concept?
One of the things that was, I was never able to get to that point when I was in Peru even. Mm-hmm. I was introduced with, professors introduced me with ideas, I think, that were very, very much questioning everything that I did.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the moments for me that it was like a breakthrough, where I was allowing myself to not be, to do things that were not necessarily representational, and as in immediate representation or literal representation of what I was thinking,
right,
but very openly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do you think someone looking at that painting would get to the same place that you were? Or would they?
I don't think it's even... I don't think that that's possible.
Really?
Yeah.
So then the end point of the painting is what? For the viewer?
See, that's the thing. I think that for... I guess then I was thinking a lot about the viewer. But I have changed my mind. To say the least.
Okay. Well, we don't feel that way about the listeners of this radio show, though. We hope you're riveted and that this is a truly transformative experience. But before we go on, I just want to say one more time that this is Tim Bowring, in case you're wondering who this madman is. And you are listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. It's indie radio. It's radio for the rest of us. And we're talking with Javier Tapia, who is a painter, professor, teacher at Virginia Commonwealth School of the Arts, and grew up in Peru, as you can tell by his accent, and has done some courageous things to bring himself to this point in his career. Let's try and fast forward a little bit and talk a little bit more about your current work and what you're doing, because I know it is, you've gone now from acrylics, I guess, to watercolor.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. Correct. A little bit.
Well, acrylic paints, oil paints, I was trying so many things, and I got to a point where watercolor, I needed a medium that I knew very little about.
Why did you need a medium?
Because I felt like I had exhausted some of the things that I was doing in other mediums, and I needed just a change of pace. I was working with oil sticks for a long time. And I realized that I had really left the brush for too long. I wanted to go back, but I didn't want to go back to oil or acrylic. And watercolor presented itself in a very, it was almost as a combination of what I was doing in Peru, with which was India Ink, which is also water based, and also I wanted to start using brushes, and so I thought, why not really explore that. So I realized that by me addressing it with a new medium, usually this is what happens. You enter in a territory that you're not familiar,
right,
and therefore you begin to do things that are new.
Seems to be a pattern in your life.
Hopefully.
Yeah? No, really. Mm-hmm. Entering into territory that's unknew and I mean, there really is a search going on there with you. There really is a I mean, you know, being a student in engineering, not being a student in engineering, deciding to be an artist, following that, transferring your classes, leaving your country, going to a new country. There's always this search for a new, you call it a medium, but it does seem to be metaphoric of your entire life.
It is. I think that's the way, I think you could see it, you could say it that way. But also, this is something, a point that I may even get more in trouble to try to go back to, but I think it's worth it. I think that when I was doing those abstraction paintings in Peru, I mean, that was my first semester of undergraduate schooling, right? But, you know, what I believe is that if you do not give yourself an opportunity to mess up, you can only worry too much about audience or worry about anybody else.
Right.
If you worry too much, you hinder, I think, a development that is really necessary for you to have as an artist.
What is that?
Which is your growth. The fact
you mean
that
define growth.
You're intimidated at first because you don't know. A lot of people forget that mediums, newness, it's something that is difficult to go through,
right.
And if you do not, you have to. It's almost as if you have to lose yourself a little bit, allow yourself to get lost, for that you can only be too careful.
Well, that's where the word courage comes in. Do you see making art as a courageous act?
I think so.
Really?
I think so, yes.
Because I think a lot of people don't. I think a lot of people think, oh yeah, artists, they're those crazy people who can't do anything else. And most of the people I know who make art are enormously courageous because, number one, they say in the face of overwhelming obstacles, they say, I'm going to do this whether I'm successful or not. I'm going to put my heart and soul into this. And I'm going to make it about constantly changing, constantly growing, and constantly challenging what I know. Would you say that's a fair?
I think so. Every time that you go into new territory, there is an element of the equation that you've moved. It's almost like you have learned to, or you have to learn, put it that way, you have to learn how to take the rug under your feet.
Oh, had to learn to having the rug pulled out from under
pulled
your feet.
Pulled out under your feet. Right. And if somebody doesn't do it for you, and this is what teachers really do, really, a good teacher usually teaches you how to do it on your own so that when they're not there, you
they can pull their own rug, right?
You pull your own rug.
Great image.
Whoop.
There you go again.
But so I really think that it is important because I just don't
I mean, do
know.
You see that? Maybe this is territory that's been overdone, but you know, when people use the word bourgeois, right, the French word bourgeois, or a bourgeois lifestyle, essentially what they're saying is that a lot of people believe that the best thing to do is to get yourself cemented into a way of life using the cultural mores and values that are currently acceptable and available. And then living that life sort of uninspected, but living that life and doing what you're supposed to do in an attempt to appear to be successful to the community around you and yet take as few chances or ask as few questions or create as little hassle. I mean, the whole idea of the bourgeois life, I guess, is to just sort of be as comfortable as you can.
Correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're saying is what?
What I'm saying is the complete opposite. What I'm saying is that if you learn that, then you're a wax museum.
There's a lot of wax museums out there walking around, don't you think?
Well, I'm afraid we're just about out of time. I want to thank you folks for tuning in to Zero Hour and hope you've enjoyed our lunch together with Javier Tapia. We look forward to seeing you on the radio every first and third Monday of the month at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. It's Indie Radio, radio for the rest of us.